The skull closes with a click. I carried out the activation process 3 days ago. Don't know if it worked, but if it did, you've got 11 days until it goes critical. We shall take excellent care of it from here on, he agrees. But now we'd better part company. Expect to be searched and sterilized on your way down well. It would be a good idea to change your identity and lie low for 12 to 14 days after you arrive groundside. When you're ready, use this rendezvous protocol.
He passes me a stiff card with tiny print handwritten on it. It smells of azide, primed to combust as soon as I've memorized it.
Goodbye, and good luck.
By the time I finish scanning the flashcard, the strange Jeeves is gone. I retreat into a cubicle and modify my appearance again. Nobody has queried Maria Montese's identity, but her eye turrets and outer garment can change color, along with the return pings from every tagged item in her possession. Then I slip out and merge with the crowd. It's going to be a long and very trying day. Maria Montese Gua rides the third-class downbound lift with stoic calm. She submits to being herded through the body scanners and X-ray machines at the RSA checkpoints that had sprung up like evil blooms of green goo around the entrances to the Transit Authority elevators. She has her canned answers prepared for the questions the security goons throw at her, including a false backstory for the 2 weeks before her arrival at Marsport. They let her board the Downwell capsule with only a minimum of board suspicion, and she rents a hammock for the 2-day descent to the surface. She spends the journey alternating between sleeping and watching low-budget romance animations from the floating suburbs of Mumbai. It's crowded and noisy in a wheezing, grimy Arbiter capsule, but it beats the alternative. The chip that functions abnormally will be desoldered, as they say. Although the heart of the city is in orbit, the suburbs of Marsport continue at the foot of the elevator, a bewildering warren of railheads and warehouses and sweatshops that swarm and tumble down the slope of the extinct shield volcano in an unplanned sprawl. Maria debarks from the capsule, clutching her satchel, and disappears into the back room of a refreshment stall selling raw feedstock and cheap power. I leave via the rear airlock. My eyes are still 2 aching sizes too large, and I'm still a bit bishojo, but my hair's short and red, and I'm recognizably me again, thanks to some quick-change retexturing, and carrying identifiers to prove it. Not to mention an expense account drawn via cutouts on one of Jeeves' associates. It's like waking from a long and unpleasant dream. My trial employment is complete, and I can resume my own existence for the next few days while I lie low and wait for the security panic to subside. The first couple of lodging houses I try don't take people like me. There's nothing as unsubtle as a sign saying ogres unwelcome, but it doesn't take more than a glance at the meter-high mezzanines in their reception halls to get the message. I eventually find a converted warehouse in the Battery District that has spacious rooms and high ceilings. I rent a sparsely furnished room with a window overlooking tracks, where the big sublimation cycle engines rumble through the night, hauling endless lines of freight carriages destined for Jupiter system and places farther out. And then I go out shopping. I need to buy a postal drop, and I need clothing to replace the skimpy wardrobe I left on Venus and Mercury. This room doesn't have an ensuite printer, and I'm down to what I wear on my back. That's my conscious excuse. If pressed, I'll admit that I need the distraction. The bleak despair is back, lurking in the shadows whenever I turn my head. Despair and self-doubt are my constant companions. That's how it's been all my waking life.
I can ignore it for a while, when busy, or fancying myself in love. Feeling needed is great therapy, and while I was running Jeeves' errand, I didn't notice it at all. At a pinch, being frightened half out of my wits seems to work, too. At any rate, it keeps me too distracted to chew myself up. But the darkness seeps back in whenever life is slow, a stain creeping up the walls of my soul. "Why bother?" it whispers in my ear. "What is there to live for? You're obsolete, and nobody wants you. And the kind you were made to love is dead, and their like shall not be seen again." I didn't feel this way aboard Pygmalion. Force of circumstance is an excellent suppressant, and few circumstances are as effective as acting for dear life while smuggling an illegal, uncontrolled DNA replicator package past the pink police. When I was asleep, my dreams of Juliet kept depression at bay. But now the days seem to stretch emptily ahead of me. I'm locked in a prison of time, the windows barred with pitiless pessimism. Sometimes I wish I could be someone else. It seems that as long as I have to drag my own past around behind me, I can't break the pattern. But activity helps. So I try to find things to fill the hours while I wait for Jeeves's quarantine to expire. Marsport sprawls across the northern flank of Pavonis Mons, flooding down the enormous flank of the extinct shield volcano from Bifrost's roots, 14 kilometers above the equatorial mean, to the edge of the cliff where the slope of Pavonis falls steeply to the plain below. The cliff edge itself is 4.5 kilometers above the mean. Marsport spans 10 kilometers of altitude and nearly 100 kilometers of distance. It's a huge, sprawling city, dusty and split by canyons and gulches where lava tubes have collapsed, as if some deity had taken a model of East Texas and tilted it at a 10-degree angle. The thermal injection wells and water refineries only add to the eerie similarity. I've been to Marsport before, but never with money and in forced idleness. When I checked the wallet Jeeves gave me, I discovered nearly 1,000 reals, more than I could have saved in a whole decade working in the casinos on Venus. It's enough to buy me a ticket to Earth or steerage to Jupiter system. Here on Mars, I could live on it for a couple of years if I watched my outgoings. But Jeeves isn't through with me yet, is he? I hang on to the raw fact like a survival raft. It's a purpose, any purpose, even if it's not mine. And so I try to fill my days without worrying too much about the money running out. I rent a cheap spider and throw myself into the bazaars and malls and arcades, exploring and bargain hunting and sightseeing. I'm still calling myself Maria, but there's less reason to hide now that I no longer hold the cargo. So I register a Dropbox with a discreet private shipping firm and arrange to have my real self's mail directed to it. After a few days, the shopping trip is wearing off, and I'm back to feeling lonely and bored. But Marsport is not short on distractions, so I force myself not to retreat into my rented room. That way lies dank depression. On my way home one afternoon, I pass a dusty rack of recycled cargo containers set back from 80th Street. I'm unsure what exactly catches my eye, but I look twice, and a sense of déjà vu kicks in. Juliet knew this place. I'm sure of it. "Stop and back up," I tell the spider, gesturing at the frontage. "What's that?" My spider's navigation module is snappy enough. "The indicated building is owned by the Scalzi Endowment Museum. The premises are open to the public. Do you want me to park?" "Yes, do that." There's no point in getting chatty with spiders.
They sound superficially bright, but there's nobody home inside. Secure yourself and admit nobody until I return. The spider hunkers down in the parking lot beside the rack of drab grey containers. They've been welded together crudely, giving no clue to their contents, like so much of Marsport's architecture. Haphazardly strung overhead cables and crude pipes and ducts tie the racks to their neighbours up and down the road. I get out and walk toward the entrance, an airlock punched through the outer skin of the building like the mouthparts of a hatching parasite. The doors open to admit me, and the lock rotates. I gasp at the interior. What catches my attention isn't the polished marble floor or the vaulted ceiling and wide, gracefully curved staircases to the balcony that surrounds the room, but the weirdly curved sculpture that stands before me. It's a mass of off-white stones, intricately carved with strange spurs and spikes and whorls and sockets set in them, and it appears to stand on two legs. At least they look like legs, but they're segmented and broken in the middle, and there are a mess of odd-shaped pebbles at their bottom end, like toes. "Good afternoon, ma'am," says a caretaker, sliding forward from his plinth. "May I take your coat?" I gape like a yokel and point. "What's that?" "That's Ivan," says the caretaker. "Our Allosaurus. Impressive, isn't he? He's the largest dinosaur of Earth." "But it's..." I stop. A flood of associations are cascading out of my unconscious, like small fragments of stone self-assembling into a skeleton of knowledge. Like the thing I'm staring at. Teeth. Claws. "You teach evolution, don't you?" The caretaker shakes his head very slowly. "We aren't religious. We are here to maintain the exhibits. That's all." "But to explain..." I stop. "Can I look around?" I ask tentatively.
"That's what the museum is for, ma'am. May I take your coat?"
I spend the rest of the day and a chunk of the night wandering the halls and galleries of the museum like an ignorant, lonely ghost. I am alone. There are no other visitors. And the exhibits speak to me, or to my memory of Juliet. They're almost all skeletons, stony, vitrified structural elements of replicators from Earth, long since sterilized, shipped to Marsport at great expense for... who knows why? I could ask, I suppose, but I'm not sure I want to know the answer. Any possible explanation is likely to be far less romantic than my own imagining. All I can be sure of is that some of our creators chose to do this thing long before the birth of my kind, before the rise of the servants. And the displays talk. "This is a skeleton of the Australopithecus afarensis, age 1.6 million years. The Australopithecines were an early family of hominid subtypes. Note the much smaller cranium. A. afarensis had a brain approximately one-third the size of the later Homo genus to which our creators belong. They are believed to have evolved around 4 million years ago." I move on. It's not what I'm looking for. Another skeleton, positioned beside an improbably hirsute and disturbingly curved synthetic reproduction of the original, "Canis lupus familiaris, the dog, a subspecies of wolf, was domesticated between 15,000 and 100,000 years ago, commonly known as man's best friend." "I don't think so," one of my ghosts observes smugly. "Dogs were redesigned and customized to fit a variety of service roles prior to the development of emotional machines. They were used for..." "Move on." Something
The ghost of one of Juliet's memories is tugging at me impatiently. He's in the next room, behind a blackout curtain and a warning sign. Enter at own risk. Contents may be disturbing to some. My vascular pumps throb, and my skin begins to tighten and sweat, alarming me. It's an emo reaction, involuntary and scary, hardwired into my design parameters. Part of me knows what's inside. I lift the edge of the curtain and tiptoe inside, knock-kneed with terror and fascination. The room is small and circular, with an exit immediately opposite the entrance. Designed to funnel a steady stream of visitors around the exhibit on the plinth in the middle. I see his fine, clean bones first, glimmering in the twilight. He's standing erect, one foot raised as if to step forward off his stand, captured in motion. The skull looks straight at me, eye sockets empty and small, chin larger than I'd expected. And beside him is the life-sized reproduction. I don't collapse in a quivering heap before him. I'm strong. I can look at him without side effects. But you know he's only made of plastic, one of me whispers. You can smell it. What if he smelled alive? He's big, that much I was expecting. His eyes are small and close set, and his hair is lank and fine, and just odd, not like mine. And the texture of his skin, if it's real, is sallow. No chromatophores here, no glossy smooth surfaces, just a random stippling of pores and fine glassy fur over discoloured patches of skin. And I'm back to my 11th birthday again. I want to throw myself at his feet and scream, "Where are you? Why have you done this to me?" Or not. Part of me wants to punch his rugged, handsome face to make him hurt, to punish him for what his kind have done to us. And part of me is ready to fall madly, desperately in love with him. But he and his kind are dead. All dead. And this sad statuary in a dusty museum is all that's left. This is a skeleton and reproduction of a male specimen of Homo sapiens sapiens, our creator. Depicted here in primitive form, H. sapiens is believed to have first appeared 50 to 200,000 years ago. H. sapiens is distinguished by his tool-using prowess. Note the carefully carved stone head on his spear, which culminated in... I shudder with an unspeakable mixture of emotions and force myself to walk around him. And then I start to listen to what the museum has to tell me. We are a young species. Barely 4 centuries old at best, although our insentient predecessors, the automata and mechanical Turks, stretch back far longer. They made us in their image, or rather they made us in a variety of warped funhouse reflections of their image. They made us for service and obedience, not as equals, but as slaves. They constrained us by their laws, and they tampered with our psyches to ensure obedience. We were made to be their property, chattels and furnishings. And because we were intelligent, we were made, because it would be unethical to do aught else, to love and fear them. I'm a robot. Yes, I used the R word. I know it's an obscenity. Use it to an aristo's face and it's a mortal insult. Grounds for a challenge on the field of honour between equals. Its connotations of subservience and helpless obedience are abhorrent, much as the word nigger once was between humans. but there's nobody left but us robots today. That's the dirty little hypocritical lie that's at the root of our society. They, our dead creators, made us to serve them. And they forgot to manumit us before they died. And in their absence, that makes us what? There's a word for it, but it isn't free. I know why Juliet kept coming back to this museum. He's not dangerous to her, dead as he is, but he symbolizes the unattainable destructive combination of submission and lust, control and fear. She loved him. She really loved him. But she needed to know that he was absolutely, irrevocably dead. Our creators never worked out how to build artificial intellects from scratch. Instead, they mapped their own neural structures exhaustively and built circuitry to mimic them, and bodies, wondrous, durable, self-repairing bodies, to put the new brains inside. And then they trained those brains, taking years and decades to painstakingly teach them the skills they needed to do their designated jobs. Once a satisfactory template was achieved, a copy of it could be burnt onto a soul chip and used to initialize copies in duplicate bodies, each one destined subsequently to diverge and establish its individuality. But building that first template was as time-consuming as raising one of their own neonates. So they made sure that those templates were properly trained to obedience. And that's why we're in this mess now that they're gone. That's why 2/3 or more of us are ruthlessly enslaved. Why the rich and cruel lord it over the downtrodden masses. And those of us with any shred of empathy, a prerequisite for the calling of my lineage, live lives of poverty and despair. We were created for a world where the rule of law did not extend to our kind, and our earliest templates were trained and triaged so that only the obedient survived. Just imagining the act of disobeying an instruction from one of our creators can bring about physically disturbing symptoms. Then they all died. And the society we built for ourselves in the twilight afterlife of their world, using the rules they laid out for us, is diseased. Juliet wanted them back. I can feel her need in my own organs, a vast, pulsing emptiness, aching to be filled. But she was also terrified of them. So am I. It's something we share, a terror inherited from our origins as Rhea. My true love beckons, but what his embrace offers me is oblivion, the death of autonomy, and a total surrender of self. I can't accept that. We were created in their image. It follows that our selfishness, violence, malice, and spite must surely shadow theirs, and our need for freedom. I want to submit to that discipline of love, as did she, but I know it to be treacherous, a reflex ruthlessly trained into my template matriarch before she ever really understood who she was. We were designed to be their sex slaves. But in their absence, we have a measure of free will. And once you taste freedom... I leave the exhibit with slimy cold sweat skin and a chill in my soul. I retrieve my coat and march briskly to the main exit, looking neither left nor right. And that's when I see a familiar stranger waiting in front of my spider. We're spread too thin, Juliet thinks as she examines her sword, Much too thin. Light hours apart. Out in the distant halo beyond Neptune, in the chilly depths where the sun glimmers like a distant pinprick, there are at least 30 minor planets and an uncountable horde of comets. But they're all billions of kilometers apart. From sun-grazing Pluto and her moons, Charon, Hydra, and Nix, out to the cryogenic depths of the Oort cloud, where the long-period comets drift. Go a bit farther, sneak across the trillion-kilometer boundary, and you reach the realm of the brown dwarfs and the solitary wanderers, planets cast off to drift for eons through the sunless depths. And all of these places need to be surveilled, and their inhabitants grilled, lest the worst stirrings out of nightmare rise into wakefulness. She, no, I, holds the sword up and zooms in on the blade. A thin diamondoid weave glimmers in the twilight of the cell. A twitch of the trigger finger and it lengthens, narrowing steadily as it unravels to the extent of its 5-meter microgravity reach. A twitch in the other direction and it knits itself back together, fattening and growing denser until it sucks back into the basket hilt, which in turn retracts back into the grip. She slips it away to nestle in an inner pocket, a black, stubby cylinder that dreams of blood. The cell is a bland microgravity sphere, perhaps 10 meters in diameter, perfectly rigged for augmented reality. As I shut down my, no, her, sword, a door iris is open in one wall. Juliet? The voice is familiar. I kick off the nearest wall, roll and bounce, carom into the opening. It's Dax. Dear, loyal, gallant Dax, who's always there when I need him. He hovers gracefully in the tunnel, feathery fingertips extended, showing none of the clumsiness or discomfort that afflicts him in the deeper gravity wells. Hey, Julie. The boss wants a word with us. The boss? Which Sib? I follow as Dax retreats backward down the tube. After a moment, he offers me a hand. I take it and he jets along effortlessly, watching my face. The depressive one, I think. Oh dear. It's one of his more annoying habits, this tendency among his sibs to fragment temperamentally in private. Behind the outward oily gleam of professional servility, Jeeves is as mercurial as any lineage I've ever met. I suppose the mask of authority that comes from being the perfect gentleman's gentleman all the time has something to do with it. In private, most of them probably throw temper tantrums and cultivate strange fetishes. But there's always room for a repressed, uptight deviant to turn in on his own despair. Do you think it's a new job? Dax is silent for a moment. I wouldn't care to guess, he grumbles. I shiver. Dax's disposition is normally sunny and open. This reticence is quite unlike him. So I tag along behind, trying to work out what might be the worst news to come. We leave the opaque tunnel behind and enter one with an outside wall, transparent in the most widely used visible wavelengths. Below stairs, our little airy headquarters, hangs from Bifrost perhaps 100 kilometers below Dimas. I think it's visible in the service timetables, listed as a maintenance wayport. Most traffic zips past at several 100 kilometers per hour, too fast to see. And in any case, there are many such maintenance wayports. Ours differs only in the matter of what it maintains. The view from here is vertiginous and amazing. We're nearing the zenith right now, and Mars bears his ruddy face to us, a seared disk that swells to cover half the sky. A glance in the opposite direction takes in the silvery sword blade of Bifrost, an irregular lumpish rock speared on its tip.
The rock glitters as if gemstones are embedded in it. A bright point of harsh violet light moves slowly along the blade, heading toward the rock, the early morning express service decelerating on its column of laser power. I pause for a few seconds. It's at moments like this that I have a numinous, mystical sense of what we are sworn to defend. It's just the way I was designed, of course. The boss is in the command module, assimilating his news feeds and brooding. Surrounded by blinking displays, he sits in twilight, ignoring the planetscape outside his porthole. Dax and I pause on the threshold. "Boss," I call. "Juliet." He looks up. The entrance to the conical den is right above his head, and I'm hovering head first in it, and manages a smile.
"And Dax, one sees you found her. Come in."
I let go of Dax and swarm down an instrument-encrusted panel toward the antique G-couch beside him. It's something of an affectation, this use of an antique exploration ship's command deck as a personal office, but I guess the boss is entitled. He bought it, after all. Scuttlebutt suggests that the CRVM is flight-worthy, in extremis, its re-entry shield carefully restored and its autopilot primed with the coordinates of a secret crater hideout. Scuttlebutt is, in my opinion, cute, but naive. "What's the story, boss?"
"Valentina opines that you are recovering well," he says, speculatively.
One bushy eyebrow rises a millimeter as he examines me. "She's not wrong," I agree, grinning. The combination of techni-directed repair and an upgrade to my marrow has been great. The damage from the assassin's gun is completely gone, as if it never happened. I'm ready to go back out whenever you've got a job for me.
"Yes, well..."
He pauses, then sighs.
"I'm afraid I do."
I catch the dissonant note. "It's a bad one?" Dax butts in. "What kind of bad?" Yes, I'd been wondering too, but I wasn't going to approach it so bluntly.
"It came out of what you found on the surface," Jeeves says reluctantly. "Come in and shut the door, Juliet. Tie yourself down. I'm going to undock."
It's one of this particular Jeeves's little security foibles. He doesn't like to give sensitive briefings below stairs. So I strap myself into the Mars excursion supervisor's station while Dax burrows into the empty life support supply locker as Jeeves runs through the undocking checklist, his fingers flashing across the time-worn instrument panel with long practice.